Let me begin by introducing our first speaker, Terry O'Neill, who heads the Garden City Long Island office of Bond, Shinnick, and King, a full-service law firm with one of the most respected labor and employment practices in New York State. His practice includes collective bargaining, arbitration, employment discrimination and litigation, wage hour matters, employee benefits, and occupational safety. He's represented over 20 school districts, as well as some of the largest in counties and municipalities in the state. In other words, he's really had exposure to the issues that we're going to discuss this morning. He has clients, too, manufacturing, recording, retail, and restaurant industries. Terry is on the executive board of the New York State Bar Association Labor and Employment Law Section and is the president-elect of the New York State Public Employer Labor Relations Association. He's an adjunct professor at St. John's Law School, where he teaches public sector labor law. Please join me in welcoming Terry O'Neill.
It is a good day to reflect, a very somber day. For those of you who haven't read the papers or saw the news last night, O.J. Simpson, two of his friends, I guess buddies in Las Vegas, have now agreed to testify against him, and looks like that unending search he's had for his wife's murder is going to have to be held up for a while he spends some time in jail. I guess we'll never know who killed his wife, so it is kind of a somber day. I first want to thank E.J. for giving me the opportunity to collaborate on this project. I wasn't familiar with the Empire Center or the Manhattan Institute when I first spoke with him, and then someone described it for me as a think tank, and I said, well, you know, I'm on my third marriage. I don't think that much, I guess. Conservative, I said, well, I guess someone could say I was conservative, but I thought it would give me a nice opportunity to do something related to the 40th year of the Taylor Law. And for those of you who didn't pick these up, there's a flyer outside that PERB has left about the anniversary for May 15th and 16th to save the date. And the irony didn't escape me that the 40th anniversary, which is 2007, is being celebrated in 2008. I guess the Triborough Amendment gave it an extension for a year, and we'll just carry on the celebration until it's resolved and reached. So, but I did think it would give me a good opportunity to not just look back on 40 years, and fortunately, depending upon how you look at it, I have been here for almost all of the 40 years. I started doing this in 1970. But I also wanted to look forward, too, because I now have a 7-year-old who probably means I will never retire. So I'll be working for a very long time. And I wanted to look and see if there was anything in the future that I could come up with that might make this a little bit better for the employers who I represent. So I tried to look for some suggestions that might be useful to taxpayers. I live in Long Beach on Long Island, the land of taxes. A speech I gave there sort of hit home when I started to think, you know, is there anything we can do? When one of my employers said, 82% of my budget are wages and wage-related items. 82%. So my punchline to that is, you know, you're not saving money by eliminating JV lacrosse. You have to do something with those budgets that's really going to have an impact. And that's sort of hit me with the increments and lanes. For those of you from schools, there just isn't a way to slow it down the way the Taylor Law now works and how it's worked under the amendments to the Taylor Law, the Triborough Amendments. So then I decided, well, how am I going to do this? Where am I going to find the time? I've been kind of busy. I teach. I said, well, this would be a good way to teach my course, get prepared for it early. And then, of course, P.S., the bottom line is now I'm not teaching my course this semester because it took a lot more time than I thought. And it was kind of an ambitious project. I looked over my outline for my course to try to find the things that were related to taxpayer issues and the 40 years, and I came up with something that was a lot longer, actually, than what we ended up with, and then EJ took it and turned it into something that I think is really a terrific product. This is what's in your packets is something that you'll be able to use as a reference source for a lot of his statistics. My opinions, you don't have to worry about, but certainly the statistics that are in there from EJ are invaluable, and they just reaffirmed a lot of the things that I had thought over the years. So what we're going to try to do is do 40 years backwards and what we're going to do in the future in probably now about 17 minutes. I'll try not to be like the guy from Federal Express who used to talk very fast, so I'll try to get through it as best I can. But And also, I'm a little humbled. Jerry Lefkowitz is in the audience. I'm going to introduce him later. He wrote the law, so it's tough to tell him what the law means or what it should mean. But he didn't do some of the amendments, so hopefully some of my comments on some of the amendments won't offend him. He's a tremendous resource to have here, and somebody who, at the head of PERB, I think will appreciate the history of the statute and the Taylor Committee report and the things that went into making the Taylor law. Pre-Taylor law, very briefly. I learned most of this from books. I was a history major. I did live through the 50s and 60s, so some of it I did see. But the parts about sovereign immunity when we were the government and we didn't have to give anything away, that's from the books. It certainly wasn't in my lifetime. The Boston police strike, it sort of slowed down public sector bargaining for many, many years. It was in 1919. And then there's a couple of things that sort of spurred the Taylor law. The Condon-Wadland was spurred, I guess, by the 1947 Buffalo teacher strike. Big connection with Buffalo. I spent a lot of time there. I've been involved with some of the teacher issues up there. I actually lived through and remember Mike Quill, the transit strike in New York City with Mayor Lindsley, as he liked to call him, and his brogue that I was told lasted only during the press conferences. I'm not sure, but it was a 12-day strike, and it affected everybody. My father commuted on buses and subways. It was a very difficult time for everybody. The New York City teacher strike, I remember seeing Al Shanker on TV all the time talking about that strike. And I remember the draconian Condon-Wadland law. In fact, I think the two go together. You can't ever say Condon-Wadland without saying draconian because of the strike penalties that were in it. So I kind of knew early on in my career that this wasn't working. The public sector wasn't working, and something had to come out of that mayhem. And what came out of it was the Taylor Committee report. And that's where I'm going to kind of start, and I think that's where I'm going to end because I think it does come full circle. The Taylor Committee report came out in 1966. There were two people on it who were very renowned in the labor movement, George Taylor, John Dunlap. And when you practice and you know, we all have hectic lives, those of us who practice labor and employment law, you know, we have 8 o'clock meetings in the morning, we have 10 o'clock meetings at night, and you go from appointment to appointment by looking in your book, and you spend a lot of time getting prepared and getting through one thing and moving to the next. So since I've been teaching, which is about the last 7 years, I teach this course. It gives you an opportunity to look at it and put it in perspective and take a look at how everything ties together. And one of the things I do now every year is I read the Taylor Committee report, and I read it to get back to the roots. And a lot of it was relevant now, and it's just as relevant to me today when you read it. It's not that long a document. It makes some very basic findings in it. It was a result of all the turmoil that occurred in the late 60s. The findings are pretty basic. It's about 4 or 5 of them that are important. It granted unions the right to organize. It empowered employers to recognize them and negotiate with them and enter into written agreements with them. The two don't go hand in hand. The actually right to organize is sort of a constitutional right. This was a statutory reaffirmation of that. And the creation of PERB came along with it, something that they recommended, and then most of this found its way right into the Taylor law, either in 67 or 69. And life without PERB, I can't imagine. It's something that I've lived with since my first day of practicing law. So there was a time without it, but since 1967, it has existed and done a tremendous amount of good for the state. In my view, the most important thing it did was reaffirm that there should be no strikes in the state of New York. I'm careful not to say the right to strike because there never was a right to strike in the state of New York. It's been historically, traditionally banned by courts, everyone who's looked into it in the public sector. I don't think it's any different today than it was back then. If you read the Taylor Committee report, they have a number of pages on why the private sector is different than the public sector and why you shouldn't be striking against government. There isn't a profit motive here. We can't shut down. We can't move our operations. It's not a reciprocal kind of relationship. It's not a profit motive like you have in the private sector. There are many, many reasons for it. And the fact that I've heard there's going to be some reexamination of that issue was kind of frightening to me, especially if you listen to EJ when he speaks and talks about what has happened during these 40 years. You'll see that the unions have done quite well under this statute. Without a quote, right to strike, something that I think if it were implemented, it would lead to many, many strikes, certainly at the outset. We had a lot of that in the beginning of the Taylor law, even without a right to strike. So I think that would be a disaster if that found its way into the legislation. So what I think emerged in 67 and 69 was what I call Taylor Law 1. And under that statute, the union got their dues check off. They got the right to bargain. They negotiated benefits, pensions. And I remember, very early on, the unions characterizing this as collective begging, which is something that when you think back and you look at the level of wages and benefits that exist now in the public sector, it's kind of interesting to have heard that term. But all of that has occurred. In fact, it's occurred everywhere in police and fire with just simply negotiations, mediation, fact-finding. There's a little bit of legislative determination still left out there, but not much. And my premise is that they would have done all of this without interest arbitration as well. And I think where the Taylor Law went astray was when the legislature got involved in changing it and implemented things that were contrary to the recommendations of the Taylor Committee. One was the interest arbitration provisions, and the second really was unrelated. It's something they hadn't talked about in there, but I'll talk a little bit about that also. Interest arbitration, the first major move that I think affects what we're talking about here today. It was enacted in 1974. I had been doing police negotiations for 3 or 4 years. We were settling, just like everybody else, just like teachers, sanitation workers, white collar, blue collars. We negotiated contracts. Police have an influence that's very powerful, whether it's in the electorate, whether it's just with the elected officials, no matter what it is, they have a tremendous influence, and they were doing quite well. They called it an experiment. That experiment now has lasted 33 years. Renewed annually in two-year increments, they do better. EJ will show you the statistics. They simply do better than everybody else, those who are subject to interest arbitration. My problems with it, there's no accountability. There's no one to go to and say, why are you doing this? And believe me, government uses, when I say government, I mean elected officials, uses this process to make deals and not be accountable. Anytime you see an interest arbitration award that's for more than 2 years, somebody agreed to do that, because under the statute, they can only do it for 2 years. We live it in Long Island. We have the $100,000 cop. We have $100,000 cops who work 120 days a year. That's not an exaggeration. I don't make those figures up. If you had a weekend job, you'd work 104 days a year. They have 12-hour shifts. They're all about appearances. That's all you hear cops talk about are appearances. They have benefits on Long Island that would astound you. I live in the city of Long Beach, a small, relatively small city. A cop who recently retired, his payout was $500,000. When he left, that was he got in sick leave, terminal pay, some accrued leave, blood days. Believe it or not, they have blood days. You give blood, you get time off, you convert it to money. I call some of them vampires. They don't like that characterization. But police commissioner who retired, who I know very well there, when he left, $60,000 in blood days alone. So they have taken this and run away with it. And that's the number one problem with it, that there's no accountability. They all blame Marty Scheinman. If you know who Marty is, he's probably one of the more gifted mediators and arbitrators in the state, if not the most gifted. And these are not, it's not his fault, but that's somebody that they can blame because he's the arbitrator who they say wrote this and did this. And he really isn't the problem. It's not the individual. And, Frank, we'd be a lot worse off if Marty wasn't the one involved in that. Secondly, sometimes they're just wrong. I had an interest arbitration award, awarding raises in a place where I was laying off police. You don't lay off police. We certainly didn't lay it off to make a good case in arbitration, and yet raises were awarded by an interest arbitrator. This fear of arbitrators. Well, let's settle because we'll do worse in arbitration. If you're in a small community, they're worried about the cost of arbitration. So they stay away from it. They settle a little bit higher. Some of the things that push this up. EJ uses the term stifling creativity. Anyone who's been in interest arbitration, the arbitrators will rarely get creative. No major changes. They say, you want major changes? Go back to the bargaining table and do it. That's why you see virtually zero police departments that I'm aware of. And I do a lot of work in Westchester, more in Westchester actually than in Long Island. Virtually none contribute towards health insurance. Why? Because interest arbitrators won't give it, so they're not going to give it at the bargaining table. There are rare exceptions to this. I negotiated a complicated deal in a city where we had low retiree contributions on behalf of the employer, so we got a 20% contribution for all actives while we gave more for retirees going forward. But that was the only way we were going to get it. So there's no creativity. They're not giving it. And you compare that with school districts. For example, on Long Island, we have about 120 school districts. Virtually all of them, there might be five that don't, but virtually all of them and make contributions towards the health insurance. It's not a weak union. NYSA is a very, very strong union, very powerful on the local level as well as the state and national level, and they've agreed to it because it's a reality. It's something that they thought the time has come. We had to do it. I was involved in negotiations where one finally fell after 17 years. There hadn't been any, and then there was a domino effect, and now virtually all the school districts contribute. And significant amounts of money, 20% of a health insurance plan now is $3,000. So interest arbitration has done a lot of things. There's a glimmer of hope. There's a couple of arbitration awards that are around recently. I don't want to get too excited about until I see if they create any precedent, but they have addressed longer schedules to get to these $100,000 salaries, some of the terminal pay obscenities, which I'll call them. They are absolutely unbelievable amounts of money that are paid out. The work schedules they've addressed a little bit, but I haven't seen any of that trickle down yet. I'm in some very poor village negotiating right now trying to get some of those concessions, and they're not having any of it. The second thing I believe that has a major impact in addition to interest arbitration was the Triborough Amendments. You know, we had the Triborough Doctrine. We had it. We were doing fine. The Court of Appeals said we didn't have to pay increments or lane movements in teacher negotiations under that. We had an emergency doctrine. It's on paper. I've actually never seen it implemented where you could do anything because it's been interpreted to mean if you're only talking about money or you're only talking about some administrative convenience, there is no emergency that could allow you to change the term and condition of employment after extended negotiations. But then when this came out in 1982, the TAIL law was amended. They now wrote the Triborough law, and in the Triborough law, you can't change any provisions of a negotiated agreement, interpreted by PERB within a year to mean increments and lanes. So, and there was a time in Long Island where things were very, very difficult. Suffolk County in particular had very active tax pack people. We negotiated a lot of zeros, which you would read in the newspaper with zeros. Well, those zeros cost the employer 3% because their increments and their lanes, they were starting with a 3% built-in increase. And that's a very difficult issue in teacher negotiations. You're having no flexibility on the biggest cost item in the contract. A side effect of that is it's been interpreted, and I could spend a half hour on this alone. Suffice it to say right now, there's no question in the legislative history that because of the Triborough law, an employer, and yes, there are times when an employer wants to go to interest arbitration, cannot petition and go to interest arbitration over the objection of the union. Contrary to what the Taylor Committee had recommended, they wanted mutual access to this. A few PERB decisions, and this is, I think, going over 40 years. The fact that I would only mention three is, I think, pretty good. Subcontracting, assignment of bargaining unit work, mandatory subjects of bargaining. In the private sector, I wouldn't disagree at all. In the public sector, I have reservations about it. This is the government we're talking about. We're not talking about taking money and putting it in your pocket. We're talking about ways to save. Should you have to negotiate? Yes. Should you have to negotiate to impasse? Yes. But at some point, should you be able to unilaterally go ahead with these items? I think government should be able to do that. Binding past practices, we're in trouble. We had the TAIL law definition of a contract is a mutual exchange of promises between the chief executive officer and a union. Well, that's what a past practice, that's how a past practice should bind you. And there actually was a case that said that a couple of years ago. It is under great attack. There's a recent case out within the last couple of weeks, Chenango Forks School District, which is, I think, eating away at that. And with all due respect, I think the only person who should be able to bind an employer to a past practice is the chief executive officer. And if it involves money, the legislative body, too. The same reason you have that notice in your contracts. Retiree health insurance. We have an unbelievable situation where unions can negotiate retiree health insurance benefits, but we can never renegotiate that because once those people are retired, the union doesn't represent them anymore, and therefore we can't negotiate with the union over changing those benefits, something that is a problem. We've had a couple of employer victories. As I'm looking at my time, I'm going to move over those pretty quickly. They're police discipline. The decision to make 207C determinations. For those of you who don't know things about 207C, I don't know if John Galligan's here. I know he's registered. Go to one of his Conference of Mayors institutes on 207 municipal benefits. They're costing millions and millions and millions of dollars. So that's an area I think really they should stay out of. And actually, it's in the process of being reexamined whether the decision should be negotiable. Right now, the procedures are, and those are difficult enough. The legislature, we're not looking there for help. 2006, they passed a number of measures which I consider to be the reverse of Condon-Wadland. They were the most regressive kind of anti-employer provisions I've ever seen. Penalties for bargaining in bad faith. You'd have to implement a union's last offer. If you went for a certain number of days without a a settlement after a contract expired. They could give 1% penalties and add them onto the settlement. I've never seen them anywhere in my life, and I actually do study this a little bit. I've never seen anywhere in the Western world or anywhere in the world at all. And the scary thing is, I'm a big proponent of democracy, one negative vote in the whole legislature on all of this, one from both houses. Solutions. So I think I have enough time to do this, hopefully. The no strike. Please, please leave it. Look at EJ's statistics. We don't have a strike problem in this state right now. We have a couple of dysfunctional areas that have labor relations problems that may never be fixed. They existed before the Taylor Law, during the Taylor Law, and will exist forever. They're Yonkers, Buffalo, and New York City Transit. Take those three away. We haven't had any real strikes in years. But look at them, and we've always had strikes there, always had problems. And there will be unions if they don't like what's going to happen. Remember, the transit strike, they had access to interest arbitration. They wouldn't go there. They chose to strike. So let's not give them another arrow in the quiver. Interest arbitration, just a little tweaking. I truly believe it's a sad thing for me to say. I never thought I'd say it. I don't know anybody out there, and I negotiate with a lot of police and fire units without interest arbitration. They've never done it. Their whole lives have been with interest arbitration. And frankly, this is contrary to what the Conference of Mayors say, so you can tell I did give some independent thought to this. I don't think you could take it away from police and fire right now. I just think it would implode. However, I certainly wouldn't expand it to anybody else. And I think you can tweak that a little bit. We mentioned in the article affordability has to be the number one factor. I would have called that inability to pay because I represent a lot of poor communities. And frankly, the poor communities shouldn't be held up to the same standard as everybody else. Everyone says, oh, you're going to balance your budget on the backs of the workers. Well, you know something? In the rest of the world, when I chose to work on Long Island and not go with Dewey Ballantyne, I knew I wasn't going to be paid the same amount of money because my employer was different. And when you go to an employer and they're poor, generally they should end up being paid poor. Yet you have some of the poorest municipalities, Buffalo, Yonkers being two perfect examples, who compare themselves with surrounding municipalities and suburban communities and want to be paid on that level. And they have been, and that's why both of them have had control boards. The ability to pay, you know, shouldn't be have you reached your constitutional tax limit, because we have plenty of places that haven't, that have a tremendous tax burden that ought to be examined. The second change in interest arbitration, I would go to last best offer interest arbitration. I think, number one, it encourages negotiations. I've used this with a number of employers where we've had it on one-issue items, and we really have negotiated. We kept moving, and finally, if we didn't come to an agreement, then we said, okay, this is it. This is what I'm going to the arbitrator with. The union said, okay, this is what I'm going to the arbitrator with. The arbitrator can only pick one, and you can do that on a package in negotiations, and I think it would encourage negotiations. It didn't work in New Jersey. That's what they say. It's New Jersey. No, it's not New York. It's New Jersey. So I wouldn't use that as a role model. I think it would allow for creative solutions. Employers are always going to have in that package somewhere something about health insurance. And if the arbitrators have to pick, I think there are some very good arbitrators out there who will do the right thing. Also, I think, you know, we have to allow the Triborough amendments have to allow employers to go to interest arbitration, especially if we get these changes. On the Triborough amendments, I think increments and lane movements, they're real money. They're lots of money. I think that has to be amended so that those are not covered by it. Then you could start getting into some creative solutions in education negotiations. But while everyone's getting their increments and getting their lanes, no one's going to touch it. They're sort of sacrosanct. Why, practically speaking, you could negotiate it. I'm sorry, why, legally you could negotiate it. Practically speaking, they just won't do it. So, you know, you can't get math and science teachers. We have hundreds of applications for elementary school teachers, PE teachers. So could you have a different pay scale for them because of supply and demand, like you do in the rest of the world, where supply and demand would govern? There's a lot to be said for it, but right now they're not even – no one even thinks of those because of this. And please let the employers petition. I'm not going to go back to the cases I mentioned, the PERB, because I think I'm out of time. Time is up. It's exactly what she says. As I said, I come back to where the Taylor Committee was before the amendments. At that point, I think the unions who have lived under that have done very well, and I think they will continue to do well. Democracy works. The people who are elected, the unions are very influential in those elections. They've done very well. Just don't take it totally out of our hands. Thank you very much.